From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Amy Salad, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross today. Her cold has finally caught up with her, and she's staying home. Some of the wounds inflicted in war are psychological, and today we talk with a man who tries to heal them. Psychiatric social worker Ray Scurfield has been counseling soldiers in the field and vets at home since Vietnam. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles gospel and soul singer Laura Lee, and we remember actor Danny Thomas. That and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq has announced that it's cutting diplomatic ties with the U.S. and several other coalition countries. Most of these had withdrawn their ambassadors from Baghdad, but kept their embassies officially open. Mike Theodulu reports from Nicosia.
A foreign ministry statement broadcast on Baghdad radio said Iraq was cutting diplomatic relations with the United States, Britain, France, Italy, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. Not included were Syria, which is in the coalition, and Turkey, where U.S. warplanes have been using bases to bomb northern Iraq. Iraq has kept diplomats in nearly all 28 countries in the coalition. These presumably will now be withdrawn. Most of the countries listed were keen not to sever ties, leaving channels open with Baghdad just in case it was willing to abide by the UN resolutions on Kuwait. At the same time, Iraq's ambassador to Turkey says Baghdad wants dialogue, but won't be pressured by Washington. He says the war could be solved by Islamic countries, a possible indication Iraq may be interested in Iranian peace proposals sent to Saddam Hussein at the weekend. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The United Nations top environmental official warned today that germ warfare is not the only danger posed by Iraq's biological weapons capability. He said that Allied bombing of Iraqi biological weapons plants could spread lethal germs throughout Europe. Linda Fasula reports from the UN.
Mustafa Tolba told reporters today that agents like anthrax are extremely difficult to get rid of and can be pushed by the wind into northern Europe. Tolba, a microbiologist, said that if biological agents were released during the Gulf War, the long-term casualties could be in the range of Hiroshima. But, he said, U.S. officials appear to be concerned mainly about the danger of biological warfare waged by Iraq and not about the consequences of striking Iraqi weapons plants. Turning to the Gulf oil spill, the UN officials said information received to date indicates that about half of the oil has already evaporated and the patches left are less than a millimeter deep. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Secretary of State James Baker told a House panel today that there are still delays in approving more than $400 million worth of U.S. housing loan guarantees for Israel. The money was promised to Israel last fall to provide housing for an influx of Soviet Jewish immigrants. Baker said the money was being held up until the Israeli government provides information about its building and settlement plans. Sources familiar with the dispute have said that Washington wants detailed information about plans to build housing for Soviet Jews in the occupied Arab territories. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 42 points to close at 2,803. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading of 277 million shares. This is NPR. President Bush has rejected a call for a Gulf War ceasefire from Jordan's King Hussein. The king made the call today in a highly critical speech that called the Allied assault on Iraq a war against all Arabs and all Muslims. The president told reporters that there will be no ceasefire until Iraqi President Saddam Hussein begins a credible unilateral withdrawal. Today, Senate Democrats revealed their agenda for the next 2 years, and it included a proposal that could reopen a fight over taxes. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and North Dakota Democrat Tom Daschle announced that one of their highest priorities will be to demand greater fairness for everyone in the tax system. For Democrats, that means tax cuts for middle and working class Americans. Senator Mitchell said he favored a proposal to cut the Social Security payroll tax, a tax burden that falls disproportionately on people making $50,000 or less. President Bush has proposed another kind of cut, a cut in the rate at which profits from stock or real estate, capital gains, are taxed. Under the new budget agreement, either a capital gains tax cut or a payroll tax cut would require additional spending cuts to balance the loss of revenue. And although there's likely to be plenty of talk about both tax proposals, it's unlikely that either one will become law. Dan Rostenkowski, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, the committee that originates tax legislation, has said he's against any tax cut. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A Phoenix grand jury has indicted seven Arizona lawmakers on bribery and conspiracy charges. Seven other people, including lobbyists and political activists, were also named in the indictment. The grand jury said the lawmakers were caught in a police sting operation in which they were offered cash to vote on behalf of legalized casino gambling in Arizona. A civil racketeering lawsuit was also filed in the case, and a court ordered the seizure of property and bank accounts belonging to 18 suspects. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Amy Sallet. Some of the wounds of war are mental, not physical. Ray Scurfield works with war's psychological casualties. He's a psychiatric social worker at a Veterans Administration hospital. In 1968, Scurfield was in Vietnam, treating soldiers in an Army field hospital. During that war, there was little idea there would be a delayed psychological impact from the trauma of combat. Now we know thousands of vets are suffering from what has come to be called post-traumatic stress disorder. Scurfield runs a clinic for vets at the American Lake VA Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. He's also been working with other health professionals at VA hospitals around the country to prepare them for the types of psychological problems they may end up treating as a result of the war in the Gulf. Earlier this week, Terry Gross spoke with Ray Scurfield about his work in Vietnam.
Can you describe some of the typical psychiatric problems that you saw?
Approximately 90% of the vets that we saw were from support troops, and about 10% were from combat troops or frontline troops, and that was roughly proportionate to the percentages of combat and support troops in country. So that meant that whether a vet was serving in a, in a direct combat role or in a combat support role, they were essentially equally likely or unlikely to become a psych casualty. So with that caveat, basically we saw a full range. Number one, of course, was primarily people who would be very anxious for a variety of reasons. The anxiety might be to the point where they were literally unable to sleep, where they were having very intrusive sleep disturbance, nightmares, for example. Sometimes there would be a reaction to the loss of a friend, and then many issues out of that. Another category would be veterans who had somewhat gone over the edge. They had kind of become kill crazy. They had gotten to the point where they had a hard time discriminating friendlies from the enemy. They were rather, saturated sometimes with issues of get back, vengeance. So they had lost a lot of people, and they had been out there for such a long time that they seemed to just kind of waver between really being in touch with the reality of what was going on and being in somewhat of a fantasy world that was sometimes not in touch with reality. All the vets oftentimes had these problems exacerbated by problems happening at home. Some vets would get a Dear John letter, their wife or their old lady wrote and said that she was involved with somebody else, or she was getting a divorce, or there was a death of perhaps someone in the family that was very close to the vet. Sometimes these kinds of events happening back home would upset the equilibrium that the vet in the war zone had been able to establish.
What were your options when someone was sent to you?
Basically, we had 30 days to make a disposition. We would try to treat them, which oftentimes consisted of a lot of sleep and rest and a chance to ventilate, talk a little bit, get stabilized, sometimes use some medications like for sleeping or anti-anxiety. And then if it was felt that they could handle it, they would be definitely sent back to their actual duty station that they had been evacuated from. The second choice was to feel that someone couldn't maybe make it back in their regular duty station, but they could make it somewhere else in country, so they'd be reassigned to another and probably a different type of job in country. And then the third choice was to actually medevac them out of the war zone.
It seems that someone in your position would be in a kind of odd role. You know, as the representative of the military, I suppose you should try to get somebody ready to go back into combat. But as the soldier's doctor, you would want to, for his own mental health, probably send him home to his family and friends as soon as possible. So it seems like a really difficult position to be in.
It was a very bizarre position to be in, particularly since most of us in the medical capacity in our unit were not career military. I likened it to the sort of a catch-22 dilemma of trying to decide if someone was too crazy to go back to combat or too sane to be evacuated to the United States, and certainly issues of what was best for the individual, what was best for the unit, were very complex. One example of that is that there was a belief at the time that if you, quote, prematurely evacuated somebody out of country, that there may well be a fixation of their symptoms, that essentially they would become entrenched in whatever pathological state they were in, and that would be exacerbated by being removed from the war zone, and that issues such as guilt and shame and so forth would just compound the problem. So the prevailing wisdom, quote-unquote, at the time was that it was always much healthier for the veteran if it were possible for the veteran to return to duty and sort of work through and fight through the psychological issues so they could have, quote, a successful completion of their tour. And that was the mindset that we had been sort of given while we were there.
That's not really believed anymore?
Well, yes and no. Ironically, what we have come to learn is that the principles that were utilized, which was treat as close to the front line as possible, tell them that this is a temporary problem and they will soon be back to their pre-trauma state and that they have to go back to their duty station, that those principles actually did wonders for reducing the acute psychiatric casualty rate while guys were in country. In other words, it seemed to help them put a lid on the issues while they were there, and as a result, there were dramatically fewer acute psych casualties in Vietnam in contrast to Korea, and dramatically less in Korea in contrast to World War II. However, what this totally ignored was, of course, the chronic or delayed legacy that might occur. And that, of course, particularly out of the Vietnam War, is what we now have been faced with over the last 20 years.
You know, you had mentioned catch-22 before, and it seems to me another catch-22 predicament you must have felt in is that, well, it's kind of normal to go crazy in combat. So if you're crazy, well, then you're really just normal, and you should go back into combat again.
That's very much it. Viktor Frankl, who survived the concentration camps and wrote Man's Search for Meaning, has a quote that I find quite apropos. An abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is normal behavior. And it was that irony, if you will, that was such an exquisitely profound dilemma that we were in. And sometimes you'd worry about the person who wasn't having a reaction.
Did you feel guilt sometimes when you'd send somebody back into combat?
Well, we would feel guilt. Definitely I would feel guilt. However, the other side of it, again, was this thing that it was drilled into us that nothing was more dangerous to a unit than a new guy. And if the choice were evacuate somebody out of country and no one would have to take his place, then I think, the decision would have been a lot simpler. But when we kept thinking about who would fill the void, it became a question of the fates of two people at that point, at least. And that was just a rationale that we used for not feeling as guilty as we might have.
When you had to decide whether to send someone back into combat or not, was one of the premises you were supposed to work under that getting back into combat was like falling off a horse? The sooner you got back on, the healthier you'd be?
Exactly. not so much the healthier you'd be, but the idea being that once you fell off the horse and were traumatized, if you never got back on a horse again, you would literally be preoccupied with the fact that you fell off the horse. You would kind of be in a frozen state of anxiety and fear, terror, if you will, about what had happened, and you were essentially bound, almost bound to that kind of an emotional state over something that you in no way would go back and face again. So obviously, again, if you can go back and face it and persevere, theoretically, you'd be able to transcend the trauma and come out of it, if not a better person, at least where you had some degree of mastery over something that that you had felt had you had been too weak for.
Do you believe that now?
I think there's a lot of virtue to that in and of itself. The problem is that, of course, when you're going back, you are facing many other traumas.
You are now working at a Veterans Administration hospital, and you treat a lot of veterans who have post-traumatic stress problems. Has what you've seen in the past few years treating veterans made you rethink any of the premises that you worked under when you were in Vietnam?
Well, definitely. I need to first say that the vast majority of vets that we see in hospitals and clinics today who are still having problems from Vietnam or Korea or World War II or Panama or Grenada never saw a psychiatric personnel of any type when they were on active duty. None. Never did. So I think all these fine principles about military psychiatry may only apply to those who a psychiatrist or a psychiatric personnel actually see, which is a very small percentage. One thing that was quite clear that I have learned over the years, as have many other people, is that there was never a discussion or even a thought during the Vietnam War that I can remember that there was any concern about chronic or delayed post-traumatic stress disorder or anything like that. The only concern was if you prematurely evacuated somebody out of country, then they might have a chronic mental condition, but there was no thought that people could be literally essentially storing away, stuffing many issues that would come back to haunt them years down the road. So that is something that became quite clear after the Vietnam War, and with all of the World War II and Korean vets that we've seen, quite clearly that happens with survivors of trauma.
We'll continue Terry's conversation with Ray Scurfield after a short break. Scurfield directs a post-traumatic stress treatment program at the American Lake VA Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. This is Fresh Air.
How seriously is post-traumatic stress being taken now, and how seriously is it being taken now in making preparations for the ground war in the Gulf?
Well, I think that there definitely have been a lot of non-believers and skeptics about the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder, and this has continued, I think, as a major problem until relatively recent times, the last few years, where there's been somewhat, I think, there's been a gradual change, and it's been more of a change recently. However, it tends to be very much focused on what do we do to conserve the fighting strength. That's the military medical mission. And so really, once the thoughts are all around what you do to make sure they can function while on active duty, they still have this discharge from active duty, and then they're out there in the world. And the transition, particularly when they have not been identified as having psychiatric problems, and a lot of them who have psychiatric problems will never identify to the military because they would be very worried that this might come back to haunt them as far as the type of discharge they would get, whether they would get in trouble with their unit commanders, and whether it would hurt their career. And so a lot of active duty soldiers and their families are afraid to go to military mental health personnel. And part of that may be perceptual on their part, and part of it may have a reality basis.
Do you think that the psychiatrists and psychiatric social workers in the Gulf will be operating on a very different set of premises than the ones you operated under when you were in Vietnam?
I'm not really sure about that. I think that from what I can see, the military psychiatry principles of proximity, immediacy, expectancy, and simplicity, which are very much the ones that are going to be operating now. I'm also not clear that that the mental health personnel in the various branches of the service all have an equal understanding and training in this. So I guess I would say I think it's going to be very spotty. I think you're going to have some mental health personnel who are much more understanding about this and some who are not. And you're going to have some unit commanders that are perhaps a little more aware of this and a number who don't believe in it even today.
There are some problems that troops in the Gulf are going to face that are very different from ones that they faced in Vietnam. And I wonder what you think some of those unique problems might be.
Well, I think that there is an area where I would see a major difference, and that, of course, has to do with Reserve and National Guard folks. And there are exceptions, but a large number, from my experience, had no intention of ever going into war. They were quite content, if you will, being weekend warriors, and I'm not using that term disparagingly, but spending one weekend a month, contributing something to their country and moving on with their life. And I think that for a number of them, quite clearly, this war caught them very unprepared. A lot of them were called to active duty in remarkably short periods of time. There has been great, I think, fracturing of families and careers. We have a much higher percentage, I think, of such active duty who are older, who had formed families, where I think the disruption is of a whole different nature than if you're an 18 or 19-year-old. And I'm not saying it's any worse, it's just quite different. And the fallout of that, I think, is really going to hit home, not while the war's being fought, but when these troops start coming back, many of whom are going to get decorated for being very brave and for what they did during the war, and they're going to come back and be told, we don't need you on active duty anymore. And a lot of them are going to come back to, I think, some very stressed and somewhat dysfunctional family and career situations. There is one other major change, of course, which I'm hoping is for the betterment, and that is the fact that everyone is now talking about, let's don't mix up the warrior with the war, like we did in Vietnam.
Right.
And if we don't agree with the administration's war policy, let's at least support our troops. And I think, I mean, that's wonderful in that regard. However, with that also, I think that's a very short-term kind of a support our troops. I'm worried that that the longer-term support for the legacy of war that goes on 10 and 20 and 30 years later is may not be there.
I'm wondering how the war in the Gulf is affecting the veterans who you're seeing with post-traumatic stress problems.
There's been a remarkable turbulence that has shot through, if you will, the veteran-patient community that I'm aware of. Many veterans are having their own memories from the war that they were in being triggered by this war, and that's not just Vietnam, but certainly the Vietnam vets that we see particularly. And there's just the range includes vets who are essentially addicted to the TV and have the adrenaline running, and part of them wants to go to the war zone and wants to fight, and part of them realizes that's crazy, and they're afraid and they're angry, and there's a feeling of helplessness. You have this whole range of responses, guys going into crises and thinking that they had taken care of their war issues, and all of a sudden, here they are again. Oh, there is one more major reaction that's going on, and that's sort of like a worry that current veterans are going to be disenfranchised. And Vietnam veterans and other veterans are now worrying that there's going to be a new priority, which there is going to be, on this new population of veterans, and that as the totem pole at the low end of the pecking order goes, the veterans from previous wars are going to be put on the back burner, and resources will be dedicated to the new ones. So there's a real fear of abandonment, and a lot of these vets felt abandoned by our country and our government before, and they're starting to feel it again.
What are you preparing yourself for now mentally in terms of receiving casualties from the Gulf War?
Well, I was depressed for quite a while, and I was denying that this was going to happen, and that went on for a few months, and I guess in December it started becoming a reality to me when I got involved in these trainings and in heavier, greater frequency. And I guess one of the things is we're trying to, in some ways, go on with business as usual and make sure that we don't forget the vets who need our help now, who are here, and that we need to be careful to take care of ourselves and make sure that our staff don't get burned out because, as is usual, we're being asked and demanded to do more with the same amount of resources. And there's a lot of reactions from the current vets, and I'm trying to marshal my thoughts and knowledge that I and others have that we've learned from the previous wars, and hope that that information put down in writing and talked about may make a difference with somebody.
Would you ever want to put yourself back in the position of being near the battlefield and being the person who had to decide whether somebody got sent back to combat or back home?
Well, let's put it this way, that's a position that people are put in, and I guess, quite frankly, I think I'm in a better position to make that kind of a call than a lot of people that I know. And
yeah.
For that reason alone, I would probably lean towards maybe doing that for a while, though I have a lot of personal issues about the war and about war, so it would be a very hard choice for me.
You're consulting with healthcare workers who will be dealing with psychiatric and medical evacuees from the Gulf. What are you telling them?
Basically, I'll be showing some film on how some of our vets are reacting to the war that was filmed by local TV. I'll be showing them some war scenes because the terror of what these evacuees have recently experienced, I think, is very important to understand. And the tendency for the veteran to and the staff member to want to deny the emotional turmoil that's going on and, let's say, only focus on the fact that someone's wounded physically, that's the tendency. And it makes it so easy for no one to deal with the emotional side. And I'm going to be exhorting people to that they have to move beyond that, and they have to be making human connections with these folks who are coming back, even if those folks coming back are saying, I don't want the connection. You have to reach out. You have to try to break through the denial.
Ray Scurfield, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Ray Scurfield spoke with Terry Gross. He's the director of a post-traumatic stress treatment program at a Veterans Administration Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. I'm Amy Sallet, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Amy Sallet with Fresh Air. Actor Danny Thomas died early this morning. Terry Gross spoke with him a few weeks ago when his autobiography was published. Coming up, Danny Thomas on the early days of television. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Laura Lee. She was an established gospel singer, but in the 70s, she tried soul music with a feminist slant. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. King Hussein of Jordan has delivered a speech highly critical of the United States-led bombing of Iraq and defending Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. NPR's John Burnett reports from Amman.
In his first speech since the war erupted, King Hussein appealed for an immediate ceasefire. The war aims to destroy all the achievements of Iraq and return it to primitive life, he said. The king also berated the United Nations for lending international legitimacy to a war he characterized as being against all Arabs and Muslims. He also warned that the Allied powers would carve up the Arab world in a way far more dangerous than the 1916 agreement that divided the region between Britain and France. The emotional speech is likely to worsen relations between Jordan and the United States, which one government minister described recently as at its lowest point in history. In Amman, I'm John Burnett reporting.
President Bush has termed not true an accusation by Jordan's King Hussein that the U.S. is waging an unjust war against Iraq. Earlier today, in testimony on Capitol Hill, Secretary of State Baker told Congress that Allied forces bombed truck convoys heading for Jordan from Iraq because of information that they were carrying Scud missiles. Baker said that Jordan was not a target of those attacks. Iraq announced today that it is breaking off diplomatic ties with the United States, Britain, France, Italy, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, all members of the Allied coalition at war with Baghdad. The Allied nations have already expelled a number of Iraqi diplomats, citing security concerns. U.S. military officials say that U.S. F-15 fighters shot down at least two Iraqi airplanes that appeared to be fleeing to Iran. From Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
U.S. military officials said that two U.S. F-15 fighter jets spotted four Iraqi planes while they were on patrol in Iraq this morning. Preliminary reports indicate the Iraqi jets were trying to flee to Iran. The F-15 shot down at least two of the Iraqi planes and may have downed two others. The U.S. version of events differs somewhat from the Saudi statement earlier in the day that U.S. jets had encountered seven Iraqi planes. The Saudis said that four were downed and three managed to escape to Iran. U.S. officials say that 120 Iraqi planes are now in Iran, 95 fighters and 25 transport planes. I'm Deborah Wong in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
According to Baghdad Radio, Iraq has killed 40 Allied soldiers and wounded almost 40 others in shelling of a border area in Saudi Arabia. But there has been no word on casualties from Allied spokesmen. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 42.5 points to close at 2,830.94 on volume of some 276 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. In Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev made a surprise television appearance this evening and declared that the Soviet Union will be preserved. It was the clearest declaration yet that the Soviet president would not let any of the 15 republics leave the Soviet Union. He said the fate of all now depends on keeping a common economic system, and he called for active participation in the Kremlin's referendum on the Union. Gorbachev said the Soviet Union is a superpower and that huge efforts were made to make it so powerful, and this could be lost very quickly. Syria's foreign minister said today that Syrian forces will not fight inside Iraq. The foreign minister is in London for meetings there with his British counterpart. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from London.
Farouk al-Shahra told reporters at London's Heathrow Airport today that the 20,000 Syrian soldiers in the U.S.-led coalition against Iraq are in Saudi Arabia for defensive purposes. Reiterating Syrian policy, al-Shahra said the Syrian troops would not be involved in an operation inside Iraq. The foreign minister's comments come a day after Syrian artillery exchanged fire with Iraqi troops for the first time. Al-Shahra is the first high-level Syrian government official to visit Britain since the two nations restored diplomatic relations last November. He's here for a two-day visit and will meet with British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd. The two are expected to devote the majority of their discussions to the war effort. This is Brian Naylor in London.
According to Allied military officials in Saudi Arabia, Iraqi forces are using wooden tanks and other decoys to confuse Allied pilots. Officials say that it's very difficult for a pilot to know if he's bombing a real target or a fake one. A military spokesman said Iraq is having some success in deflecting Allied attacks on tanks by using decoys. In trading today in Europe, the dollar continued to move down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Singer Laura Lee has had two missions in her career. In the late 60s and early 70s, she was a soul singer with a feminist bent, something unusual in the male-dominated world of soul. But then, Lee returned to the gospel music she'd sung early in her career. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles her work.
Lord, I want to be a Christian in my
Laura Lee was born in Chicago in 1945 and was adopted by Ernestine and Reverend Edward Allen Rundlis, who had been an original member of the Great Soul Stirrers gospel group. By the time she was nine, Laura was recording with the Meditation Singers, a group Ernestine Rundlis led that had once featured Della Reese and gospel great James Cleveland in its lineup. The Meditations were one of the first gospel groups to try playing nightclubs and jazz festivals. And in the early 60s, Laura caught the ear of none other than Frank Sinatra, who offered her a contract with his new record label, Reprise. She didn't want to leave gospel just then, so she turned him down. But the idea of secular music was still appealing, and in 1966, she cut a single for a small Detroit label and appeared at the Phelps Lounge in Detroit, where she was seen by talent scouts from Chess Records. Laura's first Chess recording session was too slick, but the second provided her with a strong hit.
You are dirty, dirty man, and you've got a dirty man. You are dirty, dirty man. You and that other woman are two of a kind.
Was the kind of record she'd become famous for, Laura Lee Speaks Her Mind, Like It or Lump It. It was also recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, at the justly renowned Fame Studios, where Aretha Franklin, another former gospel star, also recorded. And Laura's follow-up, Uptight Good Man, sounds uncomfortably close to some of Aretha's work.
I want a good
Further sessions in Chicago followed, and Laura Lee was one of the top touring acts of the late 60s, especially in nightclubs, where she'd used the Meditation Singers as her backup. But in 1969, Chess let her go. Good thing, too. Holland Dozier and Holland, the songwriting and producing team that had made the Supremes' first hits and had dominated Motown for a number of years, refused to move to California when Motown did. They'd started up a new label, Hot Wax, that was looking for talent, and talent was something Laura Lee had.
Wedlock is a padlock when you're married to a no-good man. Wedlock is a padlock when you're married to a no-good man. Girls, when you're tied a knot, make sure the love you got is worth leaving home for. It's hard being a faithful wife, waiting alone at night for a man who won't adore.
Wedlock is a Padlock was one of the first records Hot Wax put out, and it's fairly undistinguished. But the follow-up was the record that made Laura Lee's reputation among soul fans forever. Lyrics were a great combination of dumb and savvy, and the rights she campaigns for, among them money he can't claim in the bank in your own name and be taken out to eat at least once a week, probably sounded pretty revolutionary to some of her fans. Her biggest selling record, however, must have really enraged some of the men who listened to it.
I'm setting him up.
This none-too-subtle tale of a woman stealing all her cheating man's possessions while he's away became Laura Lee's biggest record ever, and her last big hit. Even though If You Can Beat Me Rockin' You Can Have My Chair was perhaps her finest musical moment, her career started fading during 1973, and in 1976, in poor health, she returned to the church. She joined forces with Al Green, who's produced two albums with her in recent years, and she's still singing. After all she's been through, she's probably still something of a feminist, too, and arguably more of one than she used to be. After all, who do you think wrote all those songs? Here's a clue. Not Laura Lee.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out sick today. I'm Amy Sallet. Actor Danny Thomas died early this morning. We remember him with an interview Terry recorded a few weeks ago. When TV first made its way into America's homes in the early 50s, Thomas was there in his sitcom Make Room for Daddy. In it, he played an entertainer trying to maintain a normal family life while pursuing a show business career on the road. Thomas later became a successful television producer, creating shows such as The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Andy Griffith Show, and Mod Squad. Danny Thomas grew up as Amos Jacobs, one of 10 children in a large Lebanese family. He was one of the first people in show business to include his Lebanese heritage in his public persona. Terry Gross spoke with Thomas when his new autobiography, Make Room for Danny, came out. He told Terry that when he was starting out, the public wasn't used to seeing Lebanese characters on TV.
They didn't really know about us and the migration of our people, which is why on television I brought that to the fore. This Lebanese boy, American, of course, we were all born here. So that was the hook-nosed Lebanese from Toledo, Ohio. Then I got Hans Conried to play Uncle Tanous, and then the Lebanese were then known.
Early on in your career, did people assume you were Jewish?
Yes.
Why?
Very much, because I did a lot of Yiddish comedy that I learned in burlesque as a candy butcher, selling soda pop and ice cream bars and stuff and prize packages later. I was 11 years old when I started working like that, and I did that till I was 18. So I really got an education for this God-given profession in the early days of burlesque.
Several people early in your career told you you'd never get ahead in show business unless you got your nose fixed. Now, Louis B. Mayer was one of the people who told you that. What exactly did he say?
Well, I just made light of it. I said, well, Mr. Mayer, L.B. Mayer of MGM, you know, said to me, you will go a long way. I was doing a character role, a Greek clockmaker for Margaret O'Brien and Sid Charisse and Karen Booth in a movie called The Unfinished Dance. Then Mr. Mayer sent for me and he said, you know, this is a fairyland, the movies. The not-so-good-looking people go to the movies to see the princess and the prince, and they win each other, and they fantasize that that's their life. So if you had an unsightly wart on the side of your face, wouldn't you have it removed? And I said to him, Mr. Mayer, I know what you're talking about, but it's right in the middle of my face, and I use it for breathing.
So,
and then Jack Warner wanted me to test for I'll See You in My Dreams opposite Doris Day, and I refused. I said, if you see it a couple of hundred feet of me in black and white, you'll scream, get that aardvark off my lot. And he said, and you won't have your nose fixed. I said, no, sir. I was then the highest paid nightclub entertainer in the country. And I said, I didn't tell him that. And he said, you want me to give you the part, predicated on what? And I said, did you read the script? He said, don't be a smartass. I said, I'm not being a smartass, Mr. Warner. If you read the script, you know you can't have a good-looking man in this part. You know, they tried. Cary Grant turned it down. Frank Lovejoy they wanted. And Gordon McRae. But, you see, they didn't understand that this was a not-good-looking man, a little fella, almost bald-headed, kind of heavy. And his physiognomy dictated that he would never say, I love you, to a woman. He was very shy. And I said, do you know why, Mr. Warner? Because he never believed a face like this could say, I love you, to a face like hers and get away with it. He hadn't read the script. It startled him. And I got it without fixing my nose, and then next was a jazz singer, and they didn't dare bring up nose anymore. And those were the two best things I've ever done on film.
Why didn't you ever consider fixing your nose?
Well, people used to make jokes about my nose, and I used to do a lot of jokes about my nose. Also, to be handsome and a nightclub entertainer, and of course I'm primarily a storyteller, but if I were to look down at the ringside at a very beautiful girl and her escort was never threatened by me. As a matter of fact, when I went overseas with Marlene Dietrich to entertain the troops in North Africa and Italy and Sicily and Sardinia, my opening line always was to the guys, the only reason I came here, you guys, about this Dear John letter, don't you ever worry about anybody, any man back home stealing your wife or your sweetheart, because I came here to show you what kind of man is left in the States, and I would put my lower lip under my upper lip and turn and give them a good profile, and they would scream. They would applaud like crazy. And that was my opening line, and I won them. They didn't heckle. They didn't throw paper airplanes at me and stuff, and I was warned that they would do that, but they didn't. That opening line disarmed them, as I discovered.
I'm wondering, when you watch movies now or television, do you have a good time watching people who had nose jobs over the years? <There's> lots of people who have.
Yeah, well, They wanted to be in Leeds, you know, and that never was my... And then when the Italian movies came out, then Bogey and other guys came along who were not Adonises. They were real. They were real people. And beautiful women fell in love with guys with irregular features, for heaven's sake. And I married a very beautiful little Sicilian girl, and she thought I was the most handsome thing in the world. Betty Grable told me that I was handsome. Ava Gardner said, you're a pretty man. Pretty? They like it, the little irregular. They don't want a guy shouldn't look like a girl, for heaven's sake.
We're going to take a short break. Danny Thomas spoke with Terry Gross a few weeks ago. Thomas died early this morning. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Amy. In military action today, some Iraqi jets have been shot down. The planes were leaving Iraq, apparently on their way to safety in Iran. We'll have a Pentagon report from NPR's Neil Conan, a story about war refugees crossing the border into Jordan from John Burnett in Amman. Also a report from Linda Gradstein on the West Bank. And this story, a Vietnam veterans group has conducted a new poll indicating that Americans, if given a choice, would be in opposition to the idea of a ground war in Kuwait and southern Iraq. The group maintains that Americans don't really know the true cost of ground fighting.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Danny Thomas.
Now, I want to ask you about Make Room for Daddy, which later became The Danny Thomas Show. This is your sitcom that ran from 1953 to 1964 and is still on cable and reruns. In the show, it was you played a nightclub singer and comic, and it was about you and your family. Tell me how you came up with the premise of you actually doing what it is that you did, you know, being a showbiz personality.
Well, it was an accident, really, because Louis Edelman, who produced I'll See You in My Dreams and The Jazz Singer, when Louis was let out of Warner Brothers. And the William Morris Agency, my mentor, Mr. Abe Lastfogle, the head of it, and I always called him Uncle Abe. He's the man responsible for me. They said, well, ABC was starting a network, and they were hiring people. They wanted Ray Bolger. And Uncle Abe said, you can have Ray Bolger, but you got to take Danny Thomas, too. They didn't want Danny Thomas at that time. So he said, well, they go together. And he convinced him, and he took me. Now I got Mr. Edelman to come, and Mel Shavelson, a great writer, and Mel knew me, so I invited him to the house to please let's talk about a premise. And we talked about a theatrical boarding house and this and that. And Mel said, I don't know, I can't come up with anything here, and I don't have time. I've got another project. And then I got up and made an impassioned plea to help me get on TV. And so I started walking up and down and saying, fellas, I haven't got a private life anymore. My son is 5 years old. I had nothing to do with him so far to raise him. And my daughters are growing, and I, Marlo and Teresa, and I bring home the wrong gift, the wrong toy, that my dog attacks me. My kids call me Uncle Daddy. And I'm going on. I said, I'm on the road. My daughter Marlo wrote an essay, Viva Today. My father, like every other man, is worried about securing tomorrow. What's the matter with today? My father goes everywhere, securing tomorrow for his loved ones and himself. But unfortunately for him, when his tomorrow is secure, when his tomorrow comes, his loved ones will be grown and gone, and his will be an empty tomorrow. Well, I tears came to my eyes. I'm reading this English class, eighth grade essay, Viva Today. And that's when I said, guys, I got to get on and so forth. And I'm saying, I'm on the road half the time, blah, blah, blah. And Mel said, for heaven's sakes, that's the premise. And I said, what's the premise? I had no idea that he meant what I was raving about, what I was begging for. And Lou said, oh, my goodness, yeah. And we'll call it Uncle Daddy. And Mel said, I could write that pilot overnight. And then I suddenly realized what he was talking about.
Well, it worked.
He said, sure, then you'll go the days when you made your vow to St. Jude, help me find my way in life, and you had a tough time. And I said, wait a minute. I hear what you're saying. Let's not do that. Let's pick me up right now. We have two cars. My wife has a mink coat. My kids aren't hungry. And I'm working steadily, making good money. And so then they said, my wife was listening. She said, no, you got to call the show Make Room for Daddy. Why? Well, when Danny's on the road 10, 12 weeks, Marlo or Terry or both will move in to our bedroom and their little panties and stockings and whatever, slips and whatever, you wind up in Daddy's dresser drawers. Then when I know Daddy's coming home, I get a wire arriving Tuesday. I say, okay, kids, let's make room for Daddy. So all of their stuff has got to come out of my dresser drawers so that I can get my stuff in there. And that's how that happened.
I have to tell you, I saw a picture of you in the New York Times the other day with your big cigar.
Yeah.
Something of a trademark for you, isn't it, a cigar?
Only in Make Room for Daddy. I never use a cigar on a stage, on the nightclub floor, never. And yet people say to me, I wasn't sure it was you until I saw the cigar. I say, really? But so that had to come out of TV.
Do you still smoke cigars, or is it just a prop for you?
Oh, no, I smoked. I chew it more than smoke it. I consume it backwards. I chomp on it so hard, and I don't inhale. But I only consume about 3 cigars a day, and I bet I don't smoke a half of one each time.
Your family never complained that your cigar smelled up the house?
My cigar smells? I beg your pardon. I smoke Macanudo, Prince Philip, ma'am. George Burns' cigar might smell. He smokes the cheapest cigar in the world with a piece of paper wrapped in it so it'll stay lit. And when he gets good cigars, he sends them to me. He is one of my closest friends in the world. I worship him. And I said, why don't you keep them? He said, they don't fit in my... He uses a little cigar holder, you know.
I have to ask you about your daughter, Marlo Thomas.
Yeah.
Now, she's well-known not only for her work on a sitcom, That Girl, but also for being a feminist and for her Free to Be You and Me.
Yeah.
Was it hard for you to understand when she became a feminist? And I see this as a kind of generational difference.
No, it didn't. You know, I do not criticize or interfere with my daughter's political philosophy, the Women's Lib, ERA, or Philip Donahue, my beloved son-in-law. We don't talk about religion or politics.
Danny Thomas spoke with Terry Gross a few weeks ago. Thomas died this morning of a heart attack. He had just written an autobiography called Make Room for Danny. I'm Amy Sallet.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8 Talbots. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
They say pictures don't lie, but that's not really true anymore. On the next Fresh Air, Fred Richin tells us how the computer manipulation of photos can change the truth. That and more on the next Fresh Air.